Well, as you know, we're going through the Haftorah portions in this annual cycle. The Haftorah is a section from the prophets that is assigned to each Torah portion. The Torah portion this week is called Lech Lecha. It's in Genesis, and Lech Lecha means go for yourself. And it is what God told Abram when he left the land of Ur. He sent him to the land of Canaan. And in this Torah portion in Genesis, we see Abram arriving in Canaan, and when he gets there, there's a famine. Now, you can imagine what he thought. Lord, I did what you told me to do. I get here, there's nothing to eat. And so he and Sarah, instead of sticking around, they head south. They don't go back to Ur, the east. They go south to Egypt. And, you know, that turned out. Abram had Sarah tell people that she was his sister, which was not a lie exactly, because according to Hebraic thinking, since she was a relation, it was okay to call her his sister, but he failed to tell people she was also his wife. And you know how that turned out. And when they came back out of Egypt later, Pharaoh gave them all kinds of wealth, but they also came out with a maidservant named Hagar. God promises Abram that he's going to raise up nations and kings from him. He's going to have many, many children. And so Sarah gets the bright idea, I'll tell you what, just take Hagar as a wife too. And so he does. She gives birth to Ishmael. Then Hagar gets mad and throws him out. And then as you go through, there's Lot, Abram's nephew, who also is a wealthy man. And their servants begin to fight and squawk with each other. And so he tells Lot, Abram tells Lot, says, listen, if you go to the left, to the north, I'll go to the south. If you go to the right, the south, I'll go to the north. And Lot decides he's going to go east to Sodom. And then there's a battle, and Lot and his family, his possessions all get taken. And so Abram saddles up with his servants and chases him all the way north up into the area of Syria to Damascus. There's a great battle, and he rescues Lot. And all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah have been taken, brings them back. Melchizedek comes out and blesses Abram. And in our study of Hebrews, we went over that in quite a lot of detail. And then God makes a blood covenant with Abram, changes his name to Abraham, changes Sarai to Sarah. And again, promises, if you can count the stars of the heavens, that's what your children are going to be like. And Abraham still does not have a son by Sarah. So, with that Torah portion, in ancient times, the rabbis chose to assign to that a half Torah portion from Isaiah chapter 40, beginning with verse 27. So let's turn there now. Isaiah 40, verse 27. And here's the great question. God asks Israel and says, why do you say, O Jacob? Why declare, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my cause is ignored by God? So God asks them a question, says, why are you saying this? Well, they had what they thought was a good reason to. You have to understand that when Isaiah wrote this, when God inspired Isaiah to write this, Israel was in captivity in Babylon. Most of Israel had been captured and taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. Some of Israel remained in Israel and in the area of Jerusalem. And both groups got to read this prophecy eventually. So the ones that still remain in Israel, they're looking at the Temple Mount. The temple's gone. It's been destroyed. And then the people in Babylon, the vast majority of the Israelites who are in captivity in Babylon, are thinking, we're not in our land. Our temple's been destroyed. Here we are, we're captured. They might have been tempted to start thinking, maybe the gods of Babylon are greater and more powerful than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because after all, the Babylonians won, destroyed our temple, the house of our God. They've captured us and taken us out of our land. And so God asked him, why are you guys even wondering where I'm at? Doesn't it seem kind of odd that God would ask them that? But he's rebuking them, saying, why are you even questioning where I'm at? I think if they would stop to think, they would realize God prophesied this exact thing would happen if they began to drift from his Torah. And they had drifted from his Torah. And then what God prophesied would happen, happened. If anything, their captivity and their difficulties should be proof that God is faithful to his covenant. But he says, why do you say, O Jacob, and declare, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my cause is ignored by my God? Don't you sometimes say that? I think the most discouraging thing in my life is when a brother or sister who has been a faithful believer hits a difficult time and they throw up their hands and says, well, I prayed and that didn't work. Where's God? It didn't work for me. If you've ever done that, ever said that aloud to people around you, I hope and pray that you'll go back and ask their forgiveness later when you get an answer to that question. Because that's so discouraging. We all go through difficult times. These are called tests. God promises our faith will be tested. He promises that. So why are you surprised when it is? And then it goes on to the next verse. It says, don't you know? Halo yadata yada. Don't you know? And imlo shamata. Have you not? Shema. Have you not heard? Adonai is God from of old, creator of the earth from end to end. He never grows faint or weary. Those three phrases, I think, are interesting. The Lord is God from of old, from ancient times, from olam. So he's a God who transcends time. He's creator of the earth from end to end. He's a God who transcends space. He never grows faint or weary. He is a God who transcends all power and energy. You see, time, space, and energy addressed there, and God is beyond, far beyond all of them. And I'm getting thumbs up back there. That means I'm doing a really good job teaching, right? It means that the router is on and we can go to use the iPad. Okay, everybody just hold on. Okay, I'm still not connected. Nope. They've changed the password again, apparently. Sorry. Thanks for trying. We'll just go on without. But all of the visuals that I was going to use here will be on the internet by tomorrow morning, and so you can look at them then. Because they're really awesome. You'll love them. They're great. All right. Now, this phrase, faint and weary, he never grows faint or weary. That phrase, faint and weary, is repeated three times in here. That's the first time you find it. And if we had the visuals, you'd see that the words for this are ya'af and yaga. They are very similar, three-letter words. Ya'af means faint, and yaga means weary. And ya'af comes from the word for nose. It refers to breath. You know how you can get out of breath, but physically you're still strong, right? But you're out of breath. You got to catch your breath again. Ya'af refers to the loss of breath. Yaga means loss of strength. There are two different kinds of weaknesses. One is a picture of the spiritual, because breath is when you take in something that's invisible. The air and breath are always a picture of the spiritual. A little later, it's going to talk about how we can bear up on wings as eagles. What holds up the eagle up in the sky? The air does, something invisible. When God breathed into Adam's nostrils the neshama of life, he breathed into his off, something invisible. And Yeshua says, you know, the wind blows and you don't know where it comes from or where it goes. As such is everyone who is born of the Spirit. In other words, they are operating according to something that's invisible, that can't be measured, something unseen. And so we can become faint. We become weak spiritually, though physically we're fine. There are other times we can become very weak physically, worn down in the physical realm, and spiritually be fine. But here's talking about both. And it says, he, God, never grows ya'af v'yaga, faint or weary. It says, his understanding cannot be fathomed. He gives strength to the faint. Now here, faint is used just by itself. Fresh vigor to the spent. Youths may grow ya'af and yaga, faint and weary. And young men may stumble and fall. But they who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall go up winged as eagles. They shall run, not grow weary. They shall march and not grow faint. There's weary and faint again. God never grows weary or faint. Young men who are full of strength and vigor, they can grow weary and faint. But if you wait upon the Lord, in other words, waiting upon the Lord means I can't see him. He's not here yet. I really need him to show up. When's he going to come? I can tell you when God will show up. At the very last second, that's when he shows up. If he shows up 2 seconds early, it's not him. It's always the last second. His timing's perfect. That's how you know it's him. It says, those who wait upon the Lord, they'll renew their strength. They don't become weary and faint. Now, I want us to go back and look at every time I read this, this is the third time we've gone through the Haftor portion over the last 12 years or so. And this time, as I was looking at that phrase back up in verse 28, it says, his wisdom cannot be fathomed. Better way to put it is his understanding is unsearchable. The word there is for his understanding, which is a combination of wisdom and knowledge. When you take wisdom and knowledge in Hebraic thought and put them together, the word that comes out is binah, understanding. It says God's understanding cannot be measured. It's unfathomable or unsearchable is another way to translate it. In Hebrew, it's two words. That word unsearchable, which is the one I like best, is ein cheker. Ein cheker. Ein means no or not or no way or cannot be. And cheker is an interesting word, which means to search diligently into something, to try to fathom something, to try to measure something so you can kind of define it and put your arms around it. One of the first places it's found is in Deuteronomy 13:14, when judges are about to try a capital case. The judges are commanded, then you shall investigate and hecker, make search, and ask diligently. But one of my favorites is in Psalm 95:4, where it says, in his hand are the, and here it turns hecker into a noun, it's the mechekri. His hands are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. In other words, when you try to grasp with your mind God's mind, you're fighting a losing battle. It can't be done. It can't be measured. It's immeasurable. It's unsearchable. Now this phrase, Ein Cheker, is found 4 times in the Tanakh. 4 times in the Hebrew Scriptures. And each one of them is very instructive for us because it's used in 4 very distinct and different ways. And I think it can help us with our faith if we understand what things are unsearchable. Doesn't mean we don't try to search them, but realize it's going to be futile. Now, it's okay to try to measure something that's immeasurable. It makes you feel small. It helps humble us. It helps us to appreciate how huge something is. The first place it's found is right here in Isaiah 40, verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Adonai is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is ein checher. It is unsearchable. So the first thing we discover is God's mind is beyond our ability to comprehend. His thoughts are higher than ours. His ways are higher than ours. We cannot comprehend his thoughts. If we could, we'd need to find a better God. Okay? The next place we find it, and I'm taking the books in the order they're found in the Hebrew Bible, not in the English Bible. The next place it's found is in Psalm 145:3. Psalm 145:3 says, "Great is Adonai, and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is ein hecher. It is unsearchable, his greatness. His greatness is beyond our ability to comprehend. He is everywhere at all times, though you may not see it or recognize it." I came across a quote just this morning. Robin's running a little behind, and so this is how you get your extra little quotes on Saturday morning. This is it. And we don't know who wrote this originally. It's anonymous. But listen to what it says. "Were God to fill the universe could not exist. And were God not to fill the universe could not exist. It is then through perfectly balanced self-limitation that the infinite one enables the possibility of existence." You know, the scriptures tell us that the whole world is filled with his glory. Can you see it? I think we should try to see it. It's around us all the time. If only we had eyes to see it. So on the one hand, he fills the universe, but on the other hand, it's like, God, where are you? Now the next one, and this one just really hit home with me. I kept chewing on this all week. Proverbs 25, verses 2 and 3. Proverbs 25, verses 2 and 3. "It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings, plural, is to search things out. As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable." Is that the hearts of kings? Or the heart of the king is the heart, singular, of kings, plural. The heart of kings is unsearchable. What does that mean? Who are the kings here? Is Solomon talking about himself? I think he's including himself in the group, but he's not limiting it to himself. And why did he include this proverb? Because when you open the book of Proverbs in the first chapter, the opening verses, it tells us who the book is for. It says, "The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel." Here's the purpose: "To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the simple." That's me, okay? "Prudence to the ones who aren't so bright." And then it goes on and says, "And knowledge and discretion to the youth, to the young." Solomon wrote his Proverbs for the likes of us who may be kind of simple-minded and immature, to bring us to a place of wisdom and maturity. But this particular proverb was not included in the original set of Proverbs that Solomon published, so to speak. Okay, back up a verse, Proverbs 25, verse 1. What does it say? Proverbs 25, 1 says, now this is towards the end of the book, okay? There are 31 chapters in Proverbs. So 24 have been arranged and set forth and written down by Solomon. But when it gets to chapter 25, the first verse, it says this: "These also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, transcribed." In other words, sometime after Solomon's death, years later, the men of Hezekiah, the scribes Hezekiah, went through all of Solomon's writings. And can you imagine the treasure trove they went through? They found all these Proverbs. that had not been included in the original book of Proverbs. And this is one of them. So, the book of Proverbs was written to the simple, to the immature. But Solomon also wrote this one, which he did include in the book, but later on, the servants of Hezekiah added in. But this is what we collected and found, and we've added in here of Solomon's writings. So what was Solomon thinking about? Who are the kings? Now, we've already seen that God's mind is unsearchable, that God's greatness is unsearchable. And then Job, we're going to read in just a moment, that his deeds are unsearchable. Who are these kings whose heart is also unsearchable? I don't know if I can put this into words very well, but God has made us in his image. How do you make an image of something that is eternal and limitless? How do you do that? Well, only a God whose understanding is also unlimited could do such a thing. So he made us. And he's created something in our heart that is unsearchable, that corresponds to him whose deeds and greatness and understanding are unsearchable. But he hasn't given it to everybody, or if he has, not everybody is tapping into this unsearchable thing within ourselves. Who are the ones whose hearts are unsearchable? Who are the ones who have a heart that is as limitless as God's understanding, his greatness, and his deeds? At least to some degree, to the point to where we cannot even understand it. Now, let me just say here, I don't understand my heart. It trips me up, leads me astray, confuses me at every turn. I do not trust my heart. And whenever you hear some song or some pop philosopher saying, just follow your heart, well, that's what Hitler did, and Saddam Hussein, and every other dictator and moron and addict has done on earth. Followed their heart. There's something beyond my heart that I'm to follow. Because my heart says, do this. But God says, no. Do this. Who are the kings? Here's what I think. And I invite you to think this as well, to explore this as well, to search it out. By the way, it says, it is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to hecker. There's the word hecker again, to search out. And then at the end it says, and the king of the heart is ein hecker. It is unsearchable. Who are the kings? I think the kings are men and women who want their hearts, which are created by God, to align with his heart. And they realize that our invisible God, as great and wonderful and powerful as he is, has hidden the clues to himself in this world, and especially in his word. And it's his glory to conceal a thing. And when your heart is so hungry for him, your heart begins to search out the things he has concealed. Your glory isn't his glory. His glory is to hide it. He's the origin and the creator. He's the composer of these wonderful hidden things. But we can begin to search out these things so our hearts search out what is in his heart. And any human heart that searches to know God in the depths. I can't know him in my brain. I can't understand him here. I cannot comprehend him with my five senses. But there's an invisible part of me that's not so limited. That invisible part of me can begin to search out my wonderful origin, my invisible God. Solomon was a son of David. And what did David write in Psalm 119? He says, Lord, open my eyes that I may behold wonders out of your Torah. Solomon was raised by a king, a man, David, who knew the wonder of searching out things that God had hidden. So, the question is, where is your appetite? Is your appetite only for the surface things of this world, the animal desires, the things that satisfy for just a moment and then they're gone? Or is that eternal part of you, that thing in you that's unsearchable, I at least should say, is there that part of you that's searching out for the eternal God? If so, your heart is just as unsearchable as anything else that's unsearchable. It's vast, it's huge, and it makes room for God to fill. So many of us want to grasp God with our brains. Well, our brains are pretty tiny. You don't get a small piece of Him, and it's not really Him. It's just some facet of Him. Our emotions are pretty limited, and they wear out and get numb pretty quick. So we just try to grasp God with our emotions. We're not going to get Him. If we try to grasp with our theology is pitiful. We're going to address that a little bit later. Our theology, it may be accurate as far as it goes, but the only problem is it doesn't go very far. Because it's a product of our understanding of what's not understandable. Of trying to comprehend, explain something that's incomprehensible and unexplainable. It's something deep in our hearts that clicks with God's eternality. I'm not doing very good at putting this into the words, but I'm hoping you can kind of grasp where I'm going with that. Because there's something wonderful about that passage. Anyways, we're just going to have to move on. I feel like I could just keep trying to beat this and trying to explain it. It's unsearchable. I can't explain it. So, Job 9, verses 8 to 11. I love this. It says, Job is speaking. It says, "Who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea? Who made the bear?" These are constellations now. Ursa Major and Orion, the Pleiades and the chambers of the south. "Who does great things beyond searching out, Ein Kecher, and marvelous things beyond number." But I had to include this next sentence. "Behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him." Job is saying God is invisible. He's everywhere. He's just as close as my very breath. I can't see him, can't perceive him, but look at his handiwork. And from that, I can begin to interpolate a little bit of how great and wonderful and unsearchable our God is. So God's deeds are beyond our ability to comprehend. But now there are two more uses of this term, but they're in Paul's writings. If we go to the Brit Kadashah, we find two more places, Romans 11:33. And here I believe Paul is actually thinking about this week's Haftorah portion in Isaiah 40. Romans 11:33 says, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways." So God's ways and decisions are beyond our ability to comprehend. His ways and decisions are beyond our ability to comprehend. And then one more time, in Ephesians 3, verse 8. Paul says, "To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was given, to proclaim to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Messiah." I'm quick to explain to people that I do not understand God. Such a thing's impossible. I don't understand Yeshua. I don't. And so trying to explain who he is, how he got here, his relationship to the Father, I don't even try to describe it anymore. When people say, well try, I'll give them some, and they usually say, well, that's not very satisfactory. I'll say, I know. Because it's unsearchable. I can't explain him. He's far too wonderful to explain. And why in the world we think it's incumbent upon us to be able to explain the Messiah, to explain just how it all works. Who do we think we are? Who do we think we are that we think we can somehow explain it and how it all works? I can't. But what's nice, I now find out it's impossible to understand anyway. It's unsearchable. Unsearchable. This is why I get really aggravated. I'm making a confession here. I get really aggravated at people and denominations or whatever you want to call it, who not only think they can explain him, but they insist you agree with their explanation. Or you're in danger of going to hell for eternity. I mean, really? We're to be people of faith. And our faith should be born out of love for God. And that faith and love works it out in the form of obedience. That is our response to what God has done for us. He's a wonderful Redeemer and Savior. And the response he's awaiting from us is to say, Lord, I'm following you from now on. All this other stuff isn't worth it. You're unsearchable. I know I can't understand you, but I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to grasp who you are. Because I know you love me, and I love you too. Help me to love you better. Here's my life. I'm following you from now on. And then you have an adventure that goes on for eternity. Do you ever wonder why heaven needs to be eternal? It needs to be eternal because it'll take eternity to understand and comprehend a God whose deeds and ways, decisions, understandings, his works, his Messiah are absolutely unsearchable anyway. So he gave us just enough time to accomplish those things. It's called eternity. You get it? Anyways, what a great God we have. I don't understand him, but oh my goodness, we can still know him. That's what's neat. And I don't want to embarrass Rob. Well, I don't want to embarrass Rob. But I often say, you know, we've been married for 34 years, and I know her, and I love her, but I still don't completely understand her. I just don't. It's so funny. We had a little discussion on the way over here in the car, and it's so funny how she's got all these complex, as a woman, all women have these complex facets, and they can immediately rotate to a different facets, and you know, and just express themselves a completely different way. I remember one night I put my arms around her, and I said, Robin, I love you, and you, and you, and you. But anyways, I guess I embarrassed her. I'm sorry. I did. But anyways, Ein Checker, his understanding is immeasurable. It's unsearchable. Cannot be fathomed. So let's move on. We're not going to go as slowly through the rest, but we're going to slow down a couple places here, then read through quickly at the very end. And of course, we know this next couple of verses so well. Youths may grow faint and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But they who trust in Adonai shall renew their strength. They shall go up winged as eagles. The terminology used here is basically they grow new wings. Some put it like they will renew their youth. If you've ever seen an eagle that is molting, they go through like an annual thing where they molt and lose their feathers. They can look pretty scruffy. They're kind of old and beat up and ready to fall to pieces. But once those old feathers finally fall off, then these new feathers come up and looks like a brand new eagle. And so that's the image that's being referred to here. They renew themselves. It's like they start all over. Their youth comes back. And they re-tap into that... That's not a word, retap. They go back to being young again. They're rejuvenated. And they who wait upon the Lord. The word, some people translate it hope, but the word there is to wait with hope, to wait in expectation. And waiting is so, so tough to us creatures trapped in time. It says, they shall run and not grow weary, They shall march and not grow faint. May I suggest that there is a lot in Christianity, Judaism, whatever faith community convictions you operate under. There's a lot of running and marching, and some people do it very, very well. But then God says, but there's a much better way. It's called flying, soaring. I want you to think for a moment. There's a time to run. There's a time to march. But our natural state of being should be soaring. See, when I walk, my feet are hitting the ground. My muscles and bones are all working. And, you know, we march, we walk, we run. We understand. It's very mechanical, very physical. But then when you look up, and you see, and around our house, you have a lot of hawks. You look up and see a hawk, these huge, beautiful birds. They're just stretched out there. They're at rest. And yet they're making more progress than any runner or marcher or walker could ever make. And they're doing it effortlessly. Some birds can stay aloft for weeks and months at a time. They just drop down to get some food or catch something in the air and just keep on going. Because they're borne up by something invisible, an invisible power. And as a result, they're at total rest. Yet I know people, you could call them believers, but their belief is very limited. And they're used to walking, they're good at it, and marching and running, and they are great, they're in great condition. But they see someone who's at rest, it seems like they're not doing anything, but they're really making the distance. They'll say, well, I don't believe it. I don't believe it's actually flying. I believe if I look close enough, I'd see little tiny skinny legs coming down to the earth. They're really running along. I don't believe it. I can't see it. I can't see what makes it work, so it can't be real. And they deny the evidence of their own eyes when they encounter someone who seems totally at rest and at calm and at peace and at ease, and so much is accomplished in their lives. That's the person I want to be. But that comes by waiting upon the Lord. In other words, you have to practice being still here until you mount up on wings, you can be still and at rest up there. And I'm not talking about death. I'm talking about this life. Living a life that is a life that is based upon the spiritual, not just the mechanical. Now, eventually that eagle has to land and do things, but after a while, it's back up again. Down here on the ground is what it does temporarily, once in a while. But up there, that's its element. That's the way it should be for us. That's the way it needs to be for us. And you notice he's talking about the young men, the immature. These are the walkers, the runners, the marchers. But we, old people, have been walking with the Lord a long time. We should be making distance so much faster than the young men, young women, and yet be at rest. That's what we should be, as a mature believer. And so, that's my goal for me. Well, let's move on. Chapter 41, stand silent before me, coastlands. Now, why does it say this, coastlands? Well, remember where the people are when this is written. They're in Babylon. And in Babylonian thinking, Babylon was the center of the world. And the furthest you could get away from Babylon was to the coast. Okay? So it's almost like, here we are in the center of the world in Babylon. It's not home, but here we are. But God is speaking, even in their midst, and saying all the way out to the coastlands. It says, be silent before me. Coastlands, let nations renew their strength. Let them approach to state their case. Let us come forward together for argument. Here God is not just speaking now to Israel. He's speaking to all the nations. And this is what he says. Who has roused a victor, or yours may say, a righteous one, or a champion. Translators wrestle with this word. The word there is zedek, which is very similar to tzaddik, a righteous one. But it's often translated a victor, a champion, an overcomer, who has roused a victor from the east. The question is, who is the victor? Well, in the Targum, and if we had our slides working this morning, I would show you what the Hebrew has in the Targum. The Targum is the Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. And in the Targum, it starts like this. I don't read Aramaic. It's in Hebrew letters, but it goes like this. Man aiti bigali mimadancha Avraham. What's that last word? Avraham. Abraham. They put Abraham's name right in there because the ancient translators from Hebrew to Aramaic believed that the victor was Abraham. And now you begin to see the connection to this week's Torah portion. So let's just go ahead and put Abraham in there. Who has roused Abraham from where? From the east. Now think of the encouragement this was. Where are the people now that this prophecy is being written to? In Babylon. Where did Abram come from? Babylon. God has encouraged him to say, listen, just as I raised an overcomer from Babylon, I'm going to bring you out as well. Who has roused Abraham from the east, summoned him to his service, has delivered up nations to him, and trodden sovereigns down, has rendered their swords like dust, their bows like wind-blown straw? He pursues them. He goes unscathed. No shackle is placed on his feet. What's this a reference to? It's the battle where Abram and his men go off and they fight the kings that have taken the people of Sodom, and they've taken Lot and his family and all their possessions. And Abram, he's no warrior. You know, he's a herdsman. He saddles up, takes his servants as shepherds. They take their swords, their equipment, and they chase a trained army with these kings leading them and defeat them. He pursues them. He goes unscathed. No shackle is placed on his feet. Who has wrought and achieved this? He who announced the generations from the start. What does that mean? In this week's Torah portion, God promises Abraham he'll raise up children like the sand of the sea, children like the stars of the heavens. He names the generations before they're born. He even tells Abram when he makes the covenant between the pieces, the blood covenant, he says, your descendants will be slaves in another country. He tells them how many years that will be. He says, but I'll bring them out. They went down 70 souls. They came out, we think, maybe a couple million. So he names the generations before they're even born. Who does this? He goes on, says, I, Adonai, who was first and will be with the last as well. I know a certain person in this congregation who shall remain unnamed, that when she reads a book, she goes to the last chapter and reads it first. Can you imagine? That's a crime. There should be a law against that. And if she likes the end, she'll go back and read the beginning. We all like the beginning of a book because it's designed to catch our interest. And we love the end because we know the end's going to be a happily ever after. It's that middle part that's real squishy. And for us, we all live in the middle. That's where we all live. This is where we spend our lives, in the middle of the story. So whatever you're going through in your life right now is uncomfortable. You're in that squishy middle part. But God tells us what the end is. And as wonderful as the beginning is, the end is better. All right? So. Now watch carefully what I'm about to do. Verse 5. The coastlands looked on in fear, the ends of earth trembled, they draw near and come. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, seed of Abraham, my friend. There's Abraham again. You whom I drew from the ends of the earth and called from its far corners, to whom I said, you are my servant. I chose you. I have not rejected you. Fear not, for I'm with you. Be not frightened, for I am your God. Now, what did I do? I skipped two verses, didn't I? Now, if you're just listening, you can't tell I skipped anything. Because the two verses I skipped, seem to not belong at all in this passage. They're verses 6 and 7. And they don't seem to have anything to do with what came before or what comes after. Because verses 6 and 7 are about idolaters. Now, just before we read that, I want to ask you a question. What if you got a brochure, or you're talking with a friend, they say, you've got to come visit my church or my messianic synagogue, or you've got to come. Well, tell me about it. What's it like? And they said, listen, the people are unified. There's complete unity among the people. And the people serve one another. They work hard for one another. They exhort one another to be strong. They encourage and cooperate with one another. They have training and they do discipleship. And the experienced teach the inexperienced. And there's so many accomplishments. And there's permanence. This place has been going a long time. And it's sticking to things. Wouldn't you want to try it out? Now, you probably know there's kind of a trick coming with this, because all those things I named come out of these two verses describing idolaters. Look what it says. Each one helps the other. So you see unity, you see service. Saying to his brother, be strong. So you see exhortation. The woodworker encourages the smith. The one working with the wood encourages the one working with the metal. So you see encouragement and cooperation. It says, he who smooths with a hammer encourages him who pounds with the anvil. What's being said here is the one who's putting the finishing touches on the idol is encouraging the one who's just starting the process on a new idol. The one who's at the end of the process is encouraging the one who's just starting. It's like discipleship, because you work your way up to the station. So finally now you put the finishing touches on this beautiful idol. And you're encouraging the one who's just at the beginning process, doing the rough work. So there's training. There's discipleship. He says of the riveting, or you may say the gluing, it could be either one, the attaching. He says of the attaching, it's good, well done. Good job, accomplishment, satisfaction. And he strengthens it with nails that it may not topple. We see permanence and stability as describing those who make and worship idols. What's missing in this list? Not one word of God. Not one word of love for God or obedience to God. Or service to God. Now here's the odd thing. Idol worship is very much on the decline in these modern days. You don't see much idol worship going on. You might see a Buddha here or there or whatnot, but as far as people bowing down and worshiping idols, or you say, hey, what are you doing? I'm going shopping. Oh, what are you looking for? I need to get a better idol. I want to afford a little bit bigger one to put in my living room or my front yard or whatever. That doesn't happen much. What we've done, we've simply changed what we make the idols out of. Truly, idolatry is alive and well. It's just the building materials have changed. And what we can tend to do is we can take a single concept of God, and that concept by itself can be true. But when we take that concept and remove it from who he is, we can take that thing and begin to worship it and insist that others do as well, and that they see it just as we see it. We can take a theology, and even that theology can be true. But when we take God, reduce him down to a theology, and say, this is the theology that can save you, I've got news for you. No theology can ever save you, never has saved anybody. God is the Savior. He's the Redeemer. Not your theology about him. And yet it's so easy to forget that God's the Savior and think, well, this theology is. No, you embrace this theology. You're saved. I don't think so. And I know for a fact that growing up in a godly family and in a very sound church, I did not trust God for my salvation. I trusted my theology. I didn't know God. And I've shared with you before, most of you have heard this, that I went through a Navigator series. I memorized verses. I learned how to share the four spiritual laws. I don't think about using the four spiritual laws anymore. I don't know what booklet or what is used now, what's popular to share the gospel, but I was very well trained in that. And at my end of my freshman year of college, made good friends with a son of a pastor in Canton. And through that first year of college, we got to be good buddies. And right at the end of the year, he says, "Grant, he's just talking about theology and God and salvation, this and that." He says, "How does a person go to heaven?" And I said, "Oh, well, you don't know Calvin here. Let me tell you." So I went through the four spiritual laws and led him into prayer and whatnot. And didn't see him all summer. But then that fall we came back, I saw Calvin and he had been transformed. Absolutely, totally transformed. I said, "What happened to you?" He says, "Don't you know? You led me to the Lord back in the spring. He just changed my life." So that night, Calvin led me to the Lord. You know, in that spring I shared the gospel, I was just Balaam's donkey. I was just a mouth making words. But there's power in the words. And when he spoke them back to me, and I saw it coming from a living testimonial of what the power of truth can do, then finally they pierced my own heart. They went from up here down into my heart. And I began to realize it's not theology that saves anybody. God is the Redeemer, the living Redeemer. Our theology is just our childlike best trying to explain God with sentences. But he's unsearchable, isn't he? Let's introduce people to the real, true God. There's something hardwired into us. We want to make God tangible, explainable, something that's swallowable. We want to reduce him down to a pill, to a statement, to a doctrine, a theology. And all of those attempts, in some way or other, are idolatrous. What God wants us to do is be lights. And you can't define light. You can't explain it. But people who are tired of the darkness will always be attracted to it every single time. And this is why the Messiah tells us, "Let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works." Then they can see what you're doing and building. And it's not idols. They're good works, investments in lives, not in stuff that people can worship. "That they may see your good works and give glory to you." No, but to your Father in heaven. That's what we're to be. Let your light shine. Be lights. And with that, there's a warning I have for you. You know, Beth Tikkun, as wonderful as this place is, as unique as this place is, as healthy as it is, we're just that far from being idolatrous. Always have been, always will be. Because there's a little tiny switch in our souls we can flip. And instantly we go from being a healthy believer who loves God with all our heart and soul and strength, and who loves our neighbor as ourself, to one who instead becomes an ambassador for Beth Tikkun instead of for him. You see what I'm saying? One who wants to serve the machine instead of serving him. Feed the beast. Feed the machine. Keep it running. This is why we have no programs here. We really don't have much going for us at all, honestly. We try to keep it as simple and reduced to basic, just the basic things, because there's not much here for you to have to pour your energy into. And we've had a number of people who started coming and says, "Listen, I'm here to serve. What do you want me to do?" I said, "We don't have anything for you to do. Serve your family, serve your spouse, serve your community, your kids, your people at your work. Go out there. You got 6 days to do your work. Go out there and serve them. We'll come back here. We'll feed again. We'll pray together. We'll fellowship. We'll get, you know, we'll set this day aside for God. And then go out for 6 days and just pour out your energies into the people around you. Don't pour it in here. You follow?" But we're just that far, individually and as a group, from turning this into an idol. We have to be very careful we don't do that. Men, I see your hand up. Yes, let me introduce Mem for a moment for those who don't know you. Mem is my sister-in-law. She was born and raised in Thailand. You were a Buddhist for many years growing up.
For about 15 years.
For about 15 years, yeah. And so idols were everywhere in that culture. So go ahead. She says, I read the Bible. Goes back to light again, because after all, his word is what? A lamp to our feet, a light to our path. Light is the thing that changes us. And that light, it's an intangible thing that emanates from him. It's God is light. He's who he is. So, well, the clock on the wall says I need to pick up the pace. So that's exactly what we're going to do. You know, this passage in Isaiah began with addressing the discouragement of the Israelites. Why do you say, O Jacob, why declare, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my cause is ignored by my God? Well, here is the answer. This is the encouragement. Everything that's gone before is to get us to this point. So let's pick it up with Isaiah 41, verse 8. And listen to what God says to the people who think he's abandoned them, that he's forgotten about them. This is what he says. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, seed of Abraham, my friend, you whom I drew from the ends of the earth and called from its far corners, to whom I said, you are my servant, I chose you, I have not rejected you. Fear not. For I am with you. Be not frightened, for I am your God. I strengthen you, and I help you. I uphold you with my righteous right hand. Now, all these things that he's mentioned, that he's done, are all invisible things that they were unaware of. They'd forgotten, they were unaware. But God was still doing these things without them noticing. Verse 11, shamed and chagrined shall be all who contend with you. They who strive with you shall become as nothing and shall perish. For you may seek, but shall not find those who struggle with you. Less than nothing shall be the men who battle against you. All those things that are making your life miserable right now, those emotions, those feelings, those attacks. And God may be using people, sometimes brothers and sisters. All those things that you point to and say, this is the source of my misery. God says, there's a day you're going to be looking for them and you can't find them. Where'd they go? Because he dealt with them. For I am Adonai, your God, who grasped your right hand. The right is the what? The spiritual. Who grasp your right hand, who say to you, have no fear, I will be your help. Fear not, O worm Jacob, O men of Israel. Now this is the second or third time, I have to mention this, where God has addressed Jacob and Israel. Now remember, Jacob and Israel are the same person. He was born Jacob, and then when he wrestled with God, his name is changed to Israel. Jacob means heel, Israel, prince of God. Whenever you see these names put together like this, Jacob refers to the physical and the lowly and the exterior. Israel refers to the interior, the spiritual, and the elevated. You see that at the opening of our passage. You see it again here. So what does he say? Fear not, O worm, Jacob. In the physical realm, how has Israel, the nation of Israel, been treated? Like a worm. But then it says, O men of Israel. I will help you. That word for worm, though, is a very special word. It's the word tola'at. Tola'at. In Psalm 22, which describes the crucifixion 1,000 years before crucifixion was invented, you see Messiah and you hear him say, I am a worm, a tola'at, and no man. But this worm, this tola'at, was a very special kind of worm because it was a worm from which they got the red dye in the making of the tabernacle. In Exodus 25:4, it says, blue and purple and tola'at shani, scarlet yarns and fine twined goat's hair. This is what they were to make the tabernacle from. It may be a worm, but it's that red, it's that scarlet that was an important vital part of the tabernacle. So, fear not, O worm, Jacob, O men of Israel, I will help you. I, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I will make of you a threshing board, a new thresher with many spikes. You shall thresh mountains to dust and make hills like chaff. You shall winnow them, and the wind shall carry them off. The whirlwind shall scatter them, but you shall rejoice in Adonai and glory in the Holy One of Israel. You take that last phrase and put it right beside the very first phrase that our passage started with. It says, people are whining, where are you, God? We need you. You're nowhere around. Have you forgotten us? Have you rejected us? And then you come down to this, you'll rejoice in Adonai. You'll glory in the Holy One of Israel. See, if you have that information, can you wait upon him? Can you wait? You have to. You have no choice. But you can either fret and worry and fuss and try to fix all the mess and just make it worse, or you can wait upon the Lord for him to bring this about. And if you do, you'll mount up on wings as eagles. You'll renew your strength. So, what are you going to do? Are you going to worry, or are you going to wait and hope? Are you going to try to fix it all in your own pitiful efforts, or are you going to wait in faith for God to come through and do it the right way? Dan, we're going to give you the last word.
Is that the same scarlet thread that is thrown into the sacrifice?
I believe so. The question is the same scarlet that's in the thread that's thrown in the sacrifice, for the red heifer and for doing the purification of a leper. There are a few different words for red, like the red heifer is the para aduma from Edom, Adam, which is red. But the scarlet thread, I'm almost positive, is tola'at. So we can check that out. So that's a good question. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for this wonderful, it's powerful, it's amazing passage of Scripture. And Lord, we've barely scratched the surface of it. But thank you for eternity that we can spend searching out what is unsearchable and trying to delve into something whose depths cannot be found. So, Lord, we thank you so much that you give the likes of us words and truth as wonderful as these. We give you praise and glory for it. Help us to be patient and to be faithful, even though we're stuck in the middle of the story right now. For we know that the ending is good. And we give you praise for it even now ahead of time. In Yeshua's name, amen.